What's up, everybody? It's Lee. Some of you guys might know me as Intuition, and you're tuned into Kinda Neat. Follow me on Twitter at It's Intuition. Follow my man, Ben Shim, behind the boards at I Am Database, space with two S's. You can follow us as a unit at That's Kinda Neat. You can follow us on our new Facebook page, facebook.com/kindaneat. Hit us on Instagram. Both of us have the same Instagram names out here slanging these filters on the streets. Yeah, now you can find everything wrapped up in a pretty package at kindaneat.net. And you can see our guest today, Dataless, perform a very interesting mix of music on his monome at youtube.com/thatskindaneat. I had a really busy week last week, man. I was like, flew out on Monday to Seattle, worked on Tuesday, doing a photo shoot in Seattle, flew out 6 a.m. in the morning the next day to work in Los Angeles. Then I had a day of running errands, and then Friday I had another photo gig, and then I had to run downtown to bartend afterwards, and then the next morning I did the Saul podcast, which came out, and then I had a show that night, which went swimmingly. Thank you guys all for coming out. But yeah, I wanted to give a quick shout out in Seattle. When I found out I was going there, I just put out a quick tweet/Facebook post that was like, yo, I'm going to be in Seattle for Monday night and Tuesday night. Like, what's really good? And this dude Deontay hit me up and said, hey, you should check out the restaurant that I cook at. It's called Toulouse Petit. And we ended up going there on Monday night after I kind of yelped his restaurant, and it had like 500 reviews and 4 stars, and everybody was raving about it. And so we drove the 20 minutes from our hotel. First and foremost, when we got to the hotel, we were staying at a Radisson by SeaTac, and this cute girl comes in to the elevator that we're in, and one of the guys I was with was like, oh, hey, what's going on in Seattle tonight? And he's like, oh, wait, you're in a Radisson by the hotel. You're by the airport. You're probably not from around here. And she's like, no, I'm from around here. But she was like kind of in a hurry to get on the elevator and then in a hurry to get off the elevator. And my buddies joked like, oh, man, that was a hooker. And I'm like, no way. Like, she looked mad normal. But they're like, no, yeah, dude, why would she be a local and be in a hotel or like an airport hotel at 10 at night? Like, what would she be doing here? And I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe she is a hooker. That's crazy. And so after we get back from eating, one of the homies made it his mission to try and see if he could find her on Craigslist. And lo and behold, he found her on Craigslist. And she was indeed an erotic masseuse or something, I guess. I don't know. Needless to say, none of us called her because we don't partake in those heathenistic activities. It's disgusting. But anyway, so we drove our 20 minutes from SeaTac out to downtown Seattle and ate at this place, Toulouse Petit. And the dude, Deontay, was not there that night because he was like, yeah, come through, I'll hook you up. But I just need to shout this place out because it was a fucking amazing food. It was like this kind of like Creole Cajun fusion shit. And we didn't eat a bad dish there the whole night. And they were having like some kind of happy hour thing at night from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. So everything was like cheap appetizers for like $6. And we were just pigging out on like crawfish filled beignets and like duck pate and shit. It was so bomb. And it was crazy because the whole time that we were there, they're playing like some underground rap Pandora station, and it was like Aesop Rock and Camuteo and like Blueprint and all these people that I like grew up listening to in my late teens, early 20s, and it was just interesting. And so it was so good that we ended up taking the crew that we shot with the next day back there for dinner again and ate there 2 nights in a row, and it was just amazing. Having said that, I do have a passion for food and I love food. And this conversation with Dataless starts off on a cool note where he's passionate about coffee. And we kind of start talking about that. He has a very refined coffee palate that I thought was pretty interesting. And to be honest, this was one of my like favorite conversations I've had in a while on Kinda Neat. Alfred Darlington is the guy's name. He's an exceptional beat maker, producer. He's been around in the scene doing his thing and he has an interesting story and he's a great talker, very smart guy. And I never lost interest in the conversation at all. Not that I ever do, but this one was particularly interesting. So I hope that you guys enjoy it. And without further ado, I'm going to get right into the conversation with my man, Dataless. How long have you been into coffee? When did you start realizing that was a passion?
There was a specific moment in Italy, and this was, I was on the road, so it wouldn't have been that long ago, maybe like, 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. I was touring there and just, I would re-up on coffee and caffeinated beverages. And then, man, there was like one moment on the edge of the highway where this super angry dude served me up an espresso. Mm-hmm. Surly is altogether. And I drank it and it was like the best thing I ever had at that moment. The best, just like truly, like, you know, you feel
life-changing.
Yeah, you feel your spirit exiting the top of your skull a little bit and moving towards heaven.
Wow.
Something like that. Anyway, so, but the dude was so surly. The dude was like, you know, basically spat in the cup. And that taught me an important lesson about like that style of beverage and how much is going into it. And yet also like the nature to which it's service.
He was like the coffee Nazi or something.
But he was just a roadside dude. Like he probably did it 10 million times.
Right.
And it's an important, I mean, like it was a thing where it's like that guy's probably made that thing so many times, so automatically he doesn't even think about it. The barometric pressure in the room, the weight, the speed, all these things that like affect a coffee, he's probably mastered through just sheer ignorance of it. He's probably been doing it since he was a small, tiny barista. Now he's old,
angry,
surly
barista.
And it's in a magical moment.
What is your favorite way to drink a coffee?
Oh, straight up espresso.
Just a straight espresso?
Yeah, no sugar, nothing to muddle the flavors, just to get all clean on it.
Yeah. Do you brew at home a lot then?
No, I don't trust myself.
Really?
I don't have the equipment for it. I don't have the things that make it all good.
So what are the spots? Where should Angelinos be going to get the best coffee?
Yeah, until he was good for a while. Now they've fallen off quite considerably, sadly. It's like a teardrops for them because they were real special in the area.
Mm-hmm.
First people to bring the real specialist
coffee. The one in Venice?
Venice was great. That was their flagship showroom. They had all their fancy devices and lots of airy
space. It's a very beautiful shop.
Yeah, it really is. And it still is beautiful. It's just like the OG machine. I heard a legend that they had this one machine in the back, this one espresso machine that was like the original Starbucks espresso machine.
Wow.
And that they had it like kind of like an artifact, like some sort of magic item.
Yeah.
It was just chilling back there. They would only pull shots from an occasion, but that got mothballed and sold off, I think, just recently. And so yeah, G&B is the spot right now. G&B and Go Get 'Em Tiger are my favorites. In
where
town.
Are those at?
Go Get 'Em Tiger's in Larchmont, and G&B's in like right at the bottom of Angel's Flight in downtown LA.
Nice.
They're great.
Yeah.
People who run it are enthusiastic. They're getting great coffee from all over. They're not just like a one bean shop. They're not like, you know, Stumptown, which just moved into LA. It does okay coffee, but it's just like they're only going to get Stumptown beans and whatever they're offering. So it's fine. It's just not quite as much of an adventure.
Right.
And when, at the end of the day, I mean, I think we're all, everyone that's passionate about music or this kind of temporary culture, you just want that thing that only touches down every once in a while.
Right.
And you never know where it's going to come from. It's true of food. I mean, I know so many people who are willing to spend hundreds of dollars for a meal. They won't even spend $10 for a concert, but it's the same experience. They're just, instead of it being some band that's supplying it, it's some chef.
Absolutely. Like a little pop-up chef or something.
Yeah. Whatever it is that makes it special, be it somebody who's been doing it for, you know, for a long time, or somebody that's a specialist in one kind of cuisine.
Right. That's a great analogy. I never thought of it that way. I love Larchmont, since you bring that up. It's like this little oasis in the middle of Los Angeles that doesn't make any sense. It's like this beautiful little suburb right in the middle of like, right on Western, in the middle of like surrounded by ghettos and shit. Like it's
a suburb of yoga pants.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. I had a friend who used to call it the Larchmont glow. Like when you walk around there, everyone looks so happy because it's just a bunch of like a lot of money floating around there.
Dude, it's really weird. Yeah. I find it kind of disconcerting personally, but that doesn't mean it's a bad thing necessarily. I think a little disconcertment is actually where it's at.
Right, right.
You know, disruption. Like.
Yeah. Where are you from originally?
Santa Monica.
Oh, you're from Santa Monica.
Yeah, no, I'm straight up. I haven't been able to move very far away.
No shit. I always figured perhaps you lived in some of the more artsy areas over here. Like I always took you for like a Silver Lake or Echo Park guy. You know what I mean? I didn't realize that when you told me you were driving from the west side that you're born and bred.
No, absolutely.
Nice.
I don't know about yourself, but I mean, are you LA?
No, I'm originally from out of state. I'm from Alaska. Since I moved to LA, I've been on the west side the whole time.
Are you Anchorage or something?
Fairbanks.
Fairbanks, okay.
Yeah, cool, yeah. Cool, have you played up there?
No, I never played, but I've actually been there when I was a kid. I had some like family friends that were up there, and I just remember in like very vague memories of like sunflowers that were as tall as the bus I was in.
And, yeah, that happens up
and,
there.
And like mosquitoes that were the as big as
the mosquitoes
your
are
fists.
Yeah, the state bird. That's what we call them, the state bird.
Right up.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. What
seems like an amazing place, though.
It is.
Talk about the edge of the world.
It was great. It's an interesting place to grow up, definitely an experience. But you know, now at this point, I've been down here for half my life,
right,
officially. So it's like I'm a bit climatized now. When I go back, it doesn't quite feel like home anymore. Do you have generations in California?
No. All my relatives kind of came here during that wave of 60s, 70s, just transformation,
California,
change,
or
California.
Bust.
Yeah, exactly.
Where are the folks from originally?
Michigan and Illinois, Chicago and
Detroit,
Grand Rapids.
Oh, Grand Rapids. Yeah. Okay. What brought them out here?
Yeah, both of them in the kind of art and educational world.
Uh-huh.
My dad was an experimental psychologist, and then later more of an educator and bureaucrat is the wrong term, but just kind of like on the background of education.
Yeah.
He did some of those straight up, like, you know, teaching and stuff for a period of time, and then became more of an administrator. On my mom's side, she's a fine artist, still practices, still does the work, still shows. And then on the flip, that was something that she became the dean of fine arts at USC for a period of time.
So, oh, wow.
Kind of more on that, like on a high level administrative side.
What was her medium of choice?
She's a printmaker and oil painter.
Nice.
And especially highly interested in Judaism. She's a Judaical artist, I guess is the phrase.
Okay. So were you raised in a Judaism in your life?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Sort of weird. Like, and I don't. There's a lot of mix up to this, but like my mom at a certain point really rediscovered her religious roots that she doesn't necessarily have. And I don't mean that in a mean way. I just mean that she is a very practicing Jewish person. But if you met her grandmother, my grandmother, I should say, her mom,
yeah.
She wasn't super like she did Jewish stuff, but it wasn't like she was
right.
Holding the lighting the menorah, I think, in a way. So I think it's very common for people to kind of discover roots that aren't necessarily things that are part of them, but they don't necessarily own in the same way until
right.
later in life.
It's almost this kind of human nature to like rebel in one way or another, whether it be rebelling against your parents by not being religious if they were religious, or going like, oh, hey, we have this religious history and you never taught me about it.
Sure.
So that's almost a form of rebellion in and of itself.
Just finding any kind of order to this chaos.
Yeah.
We all live in a certain amount of mess. And
yeah,
so
absolutely.
I think when people find their structure, and I never was personally so into it, but I was certainly raised at a certain point in my childhood when this kind of change happened, it suddenly became something that was a little bit more on the mind and on her mind. And when we still had Christmas trees every year in little odds and ends, but there was a certain point where I did some things as kind of a show, and now I'm cool with it not being part of my mix. So
right,
much.
Right. Did you have to do the whole bar mitzvah and everything with that?
Totally, yeah. I learned some words and I said those words, and now I'm supposedly part of a tribe.
Weren't into it though?
Nah.
Yeah. What was dad's religious beliefs?
He was like, yeah, nothing. There's not much religion in his family. I'm sure if you go back a bit, I mean, everybody seems like they had that emphasis in the early American life that was, you had to be part of some sort of organization or tribe or whatever to kind of make it in that kind of squirrelier nature of things. But as it happens, he, at least for as far back as they remember, they've all been atheists. And not even agnostic, just like straight up nothing there.
Yeah.
Salt of the earth kind of people, like farmers and stuff, you know, people who you kind of begin and end with what you get out of the ground. Either you're going back into it or you're getting something out of it. So I think there's something to that.
Your last name's Darlington, right?
Now it is.
Oh, it wasn't before.
No.
Oh, okay. My bad.
Cool. No sweat. No,
that's a nom de plume that you took on?
What it is it's kind of like a nom de plume, but it's less of an alias, less like Daedalus being a name. It's actually my wife and I, when we were getting married, my last name was Weisberg Roberts. Weisberg being my mom's, Roberts being my dad's.
Okay.
A hyphenated and created last name. And it's beautiful that both myself and my sister got this name and were conjoined in this way for my parents. But also it's hard to pass that on necessarily to my wife, who was less, you know, it's like surnames are already tricky enough.
Right.
And then for my wife, I think her last name didn't have as much meaning. It wasn't generational. It also had been changed in the previous generation. So less connection with that, I believe, is the way to put it. So when it came time for us to be married and all the question marks about name changes, we decided instead to find a new name together.
Create your own.
Mm-hmm. And then based on our history, too, there was a Darlington Street in Santa Monica that had a special importance to us.
So oh, wow.
We decided to make that an emphasis, to kind of go there.
That's very interesting and awesome. I like the last name Darlington, too, because it sounds so regal. Doesn't it sound very royal?
We thought about darling, yeah. Just to make it a little shorter rather than having that extra bit of spelling that adds, maybe raises some question marks. But that's a little, you know, any kind of language has meaning. It's very rare. Like, we're one of the very few cultures where names don't have direct meaning.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other cultures, you have a name that actually means something in that environment. So you have this reference point.
Right.
We have all these names that just float, or they're biblical. And obviously that has meaning as well, too, but just not the same.
Right.
So it's kind of fun to kind of pull from something that maybe has less total meaning, but it has like a little bit of an emphasis. Like, it makes your scalp itch a little bit, like you were talking
about.
Yeah,
like absolutely.
It has a little regalness, maybe. That's cool.
Yeah. Dad's experimental psychology. What was that about? Like, during the 60s and 70s, was it experimenting on with strange drugs that we might look back upon? Like, what?
Nothing super cool like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I did my own fair share
yeah,
of that I put on that research and got my PhD, I think, sadly, or wonderfully. He was doing paraphrase theory. At least that's what he got his thesis paper in. Now, paraphrase theory is fascinating, maybe not to listeners totally, but paraphrase theory being this wonderful emphasis or wonderful examination of language in its smallest units.
Okay.
So especially when he was doing it partially for the military, which I don't know totally the story on that. I've only gotten so much of the oral history out of that. But basically it's studying the smallest units of information, smallest units of word choice to make for information expression.
Uh-huh.
So you might just grunt something like.
Mm. So like analyzing micro slicing, like videotaping and stop pausing type stuff.
Or? This is far before the invention of videotape.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, straight up, he was like, I mean, I'm sure it was, you know, I think there were a mixture of doing things directly with participants and then also just like animal experiments and stuff. I know he used to run the lab at the University of Michigan for some of the animals and stuff.
Yeah.
Some weird monkey.
So it wasn't like, it wasn't like psychiatry style. Though, or anything like that. Like
that's the thing. Yeah. So much more on the back end,
yeah.
Like the actual like science, like not, I'm not saying that like psychoanalysis is not scientifically
right.
based, but dude, it's like, it's sometimes it's some pretty severe mumbo jumbo, especially, you know, it's somebody's opinion more than it is science fact. And
yeah.
So he was more on the scientific fact side of it.
Yeah.
But still, we know so little about the human brain.
Absolutely.
That it's, you know, scratching a surface more than anything else. And he, you know, he taught for a period of time on memory studies. I actually inherited this awesome shirt when I was a kid. It said Dr. Memory on it because he got it as a present from his students when he was teaching at UCLA. Just, you know.
Yeah. I was asking when I heard the, you know, experimental psychology thing, mm-hmm. my mother got her master's in, child psychology / child counseling, like elementary counseling. And so I remember, you know, when my brother and I would get in trouble, she would always have some new fandangled, like trendy way to try and punish us
sure.
or like not really put it. Like I remember the funniest one was when we would get angry at each other, she would sit us down in a chair, like we're similar to how we're sitting mm-hmm. and we would have to compliment each other for 5 minutes back and forth.
Wow.
And I was just trying to see if you had any funny stories like that.
Dude, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah. It was ridiculous. I don't know if it ever really helped that much. It kind of just made us angrier. But anyhow,
there has to be a lens to focus through. Right. And then it's hard. Some of that stuff is just the reason we're not all complimenting each other across. We're not mediating through compliments is probably because it was,
you know,
a moment in time.
There you go. You said you have a sister?
I do have a sister.
She's older or younger?
4 years older. She lives in Hong Kong.
Wow.
She's a professor of art history. I want to say, I don't know if it's in her emphasis or if it's more general, but yeah, Hong Kong, not mainland, obviously, but like part of that whole mix-up that's going on out there right now.
Wow. It sounds like you guys grew up in a very artistic household, very like free-thinking household.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly Santa Monica at that time was probably very open and free-thinking.
Yeah, like crazy.
What were you like as a child? Like what was elementary school like for you? You know what I mean? Like you seem really, really smart.
That's interesting you say that. I don't feel terribly like that. I've surrounded myself in my life. I've been surrounded by and I feel like I surround myself with very talented, very bright people.
Absolutely.
And I oftentimes feel like not the brightest bulb in the pack.
But it's good to be around people that make you feel like you're not the smartest person in the room.
Yeah, and I think it's an underemphasized, talking about some silly experimental psychology stuff, I feel it's important to know your place in things and to know not limitations, but more like feel the walls around us
mm-hmm.
and to kind of, you know, to strive towards being better, but also to realize that we're not the most special, singular, beautiful star in the sky.
Right, right.
And I think by just always asking those questions and always, you know, being in that box, it helps. But anyways, elementary school, I don't remember terribly much. I remember very vividly that Santa Monica, where I grew up on Southside Santa Monica, was very much dog town.
Okay.
And that's a term I didn't really hear too much in a good way. For a long time. Nowadays, we can talk
now
about
it's
dog
very glorified. Yeah,
it's like the invention of modern skating and all this stuff.
Right.
It's great. At the time, I just remember a lot of like vague gang stuff, like the V13 in Venice. Venice 13 was like always a really scary thing. So if you went a little too far south, you would encounter them. All the skate punks and like surf Nazis and all that stuff. That was just
right.
That was kind of what was happening, even though there was like this pervasive artistic attitude and almost a communist approach to the government in Santa Monica. Santa Monica was this little island against the rest of Los Angeles. Those of listening might not know the Jack's geography. There's like these, LA is this large county, but then it consists of these cities that don't necessarily constitute a Los Angeles city. So you have a place like Culver City was also an independent island of cityness alongside Santa Monica. And there's a few others in the kind of greater border that is Los Angeles County. And so there's a lot of freedom afforded both in the governance of Santa Monica and then also in a weird fashion too, even like the police actually were people that lived in Santa Monica, unlike the LAPD, which oftentimes they live in the border towns and they police areas like Compton or whatever that they don't actually live in. And I feel like it changes the relationship, say, of the governance if they actually live in their city they're governing. Anyways,
right?
A lot of freedom growing up there and a lot of opportunities for other people's freedom to directly impact my face.
Right.
In that way.
Well, and that's the interesting thing is now in modern Los Angeles, Venice and Santa Monica are these extremely desirable places to live, high end, high rent, good people in general there. But back in the, you know, 70s, early 80s, et cetera, like it was pretty dangerous.
Well, just crack.
Yeah.
Crack hit in this crazy fashion. And I don't remember the exact moment that the things turned, but it was definitely like, tough times economically. And then things got crazy in LA, the gang violence that really ramped up and led in through what would be the early 90s when it kind of surfaced in a more nationwide consciousness. It's just like, that happened. To just be a small kid witnessing it and just the cultural shifts and stuff. And it's exhilarating and I'm happy to be from here, but also, I think a certain amount of being a musician or any musician is an interest in having your story told, obviously the expression through music and stuff, but also that weird psychological crutch of somehow needing to be heard. It's like such a big part of it. And I feel like when your voice gets taken away from you because of a childhood thing or because it's something that you're not given easily. I think it's where a lot of musicians come from psychologically. And I feel like, there were some times when I was the awkward kid in elementary school and these other spaces that made it so that now I'm a pretty damn motivated musician.
Right. When your voice is taken away as a child, you strive to get it heard later on in life. And so in what ways do you feel like your voice is getting taken as a child?
Just being awkward, I think.
Yeah.
And then not having that many, I had some very close friends growing up, but then
I feel like you probably hung out with a lot of adults when you were younger. Like, did your parents have a lot of dinner parties and stuff like that?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And I'm sure you were Alfred, come in and show them what you can do, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that actually happened a fair bit. I never thought about that, but there was definitely, here's the thing though. I was a second kid. Uh-huh. So I was also a little bit being able to hide under the table and listen to the big kids talk and listen to the adults do their thing. And my sister she wasn't a performer or something. She wasn't paraded around, but she definitely has been a bright light. So she's a good person for that kind of conversational talk. I was probably afforded a lot more leeway.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, literally my parents and all their psychological mumbo jumbo, I had no oversight. There was periods of time when I could just leave the house for days.
I've heard that, the first kid you protect with your last
especially
dying breath and the second
the daughter,
one,
especially.
Yeah. The first daughter. And then the second child, you'll let him juggle knives or whatever. And were you a prodigious youth? Did music come to you early? Or what were your early talents?
Yeah, that's the thing. I had an early failure that led to music. And that was, I really wanted to be an inventor when I was really young. My parents kind of teased me about the fact that I would take apart all the electronics in the house, but I could never put them back together.
Right.
I had fumbly fingers.
You wanted to see how things worked.
Totally. But in that way of I was looking for magic in them, not so much the mechanics in them. The boring things didn't really interest me too much. It was more like the danger or the ephemeral thing. Like when you break open a television, you can hear the squeal of it. And as the rare gases escape, this is like an old tube television, not the LED, LCD things. And that kind of magic of this thing's literally explodes when you hit it hard enough with a hammer. Now that obviously isn't going to come back from the dead. You're not going to fix that thing. And other kids probably that's where they got to, but I was looking for that in the thing. That failure of being able to put things back together. And, it's I think when my parents saw this interest, they bought me all those little kits, build your own circuit.
Erector sets and stuff like
that. Totally.
And
I never was interested in that stuff. It's funny how we get to the places we get. And music very quickly became something that I could focus on that could be something. Now, I never was very good at it. I've become slightly proud of this. It's I've never been very talented at music. It's never been easy and it took a lot of practice. But that was the thing in the end, actually. That's the thing I'm most interested in, is that weird journey that you get there with, not so much the prodigies who are really naturally good.
Right.
And tend to not write music. Now, that's a quandary, right? Like, I don't understand how that happens.
Yeah,
so many super talented players who just don't
memorize and play concertos, but don't create. Yeah.
Don't create. They don't feel the emphasis. They don't feel the need to, like, put back out, even though obviously they're part of the communication method. They're part of the, they're amazing people, amazing players, but they just, why don't they write? Why isn't everybody trying to desperately fill this void that we're all leaving when we're passing?
Mm-hmm.
That's a question mark and a half. The whole thing of, like, you know, we're all going to be filling dirt somewhere in some regard. And why aren't we all desperately trying to create as much as possible out of that? I mean,
how to leave something behind.
Yeah. What makes us happy enough to, like, sit here and just to let it happen?
Do you worry about your legacy a lot?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's it. That's everything.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I mean, maybe kids someday, but that's a different kind of legacy. That's a little bit adding to the problem somewhat rather than just a solution. It isn't like you have kids and it's solved.
Right.
Like this kind of desperation to be heard, this desperation to have a legacy, this, all these little desperate measures, just, you know, it's part of the communication we're all having constantly. And I see people with, you know, people in their kind of social media desperation, their need to be heard in that regard and their need to have the numbers and this dopamine fix. And it's a little bit of an addiction. It's a little bit of a part of our mortal coil that we're all running and stuff.
Yeah, I find it very interesting, and I agree completely with what you're saying, but it's already been brought up quite a bit as far as, like, well, one, you know, you talk about, like, your dad not thinking that everyone was, like, a special individual snowflake or something like that, or his family. I can't remember exactly how you worded it, but basically on some, we're not all as special as we think, essentially.
They're very Midwest like that. Right. So they had a strong dose of the Midwest, like, we're cool.
But at the same time, I like how you openly admit that, like, yeah, musicians, we're kind of self-centered people and we do want to be heard. And like, that's, no matter how humble someone says they may or may not be, like, the point is that if you didn't feel like you had something to say, you wouldn't be making music.
Oh my God.
And if you didn't want somebody to hear what you were saying, you know what I mean? Because nobody really writes songs just for themselves to listen to.
Well, I mean,
unless that becomes part of their PR story,
yeah,
in my opinion.
And you should never believe your own PR
story.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's written. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, you're absolutely correct. It is a strange compulsion to basically yell at our top of our lungs something that somebody else is supposed to feel. Now, I heard something recently that blew my mind a little bit, but made perfect sense. Have you heard of mirror neurons?
I've not.
Okay, so mirror neurons are part of our brain. It's a neuron that fires not only when we do something, but when we see somebody doing something. But it fires off as if we're doing it. So there's a satisfactory feeling in seeing somebody perform a task or see someone do something because it's somehow you're the one feeling like you're doing
it. You get some of the leftover glory from it.
Yeah. And it makes perfect sense for all of our forms of media, all of our weird porn consumption, all of our just everything that we're out there perceiving and witnessing is
laughing at a joke, maybe.
But that's like, yeah, that's also scratching a different itch as well. This is like laughing at a joke is maybe seeing this kind of weird, that weird itchy discomfort that becomes laughter. And this, I think, is almost like you see it and you feel that you're doing it and therefore you're part of this communication. So I do often think about how weird it is that as a musician, I'm up on stage basically yelling at audiences. And I like to think that with my style performance, there is a dialogue that's possible or there's a back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. But truth is, it's often like a monologue. I am much louder than my audience could ever be in this mix. And they can give me a lot of facial expressions or applause or whatever, you know, or boos or whatever this kind of thing that they're giving me. But I'm a lot louder than they are. And so why does somebody like that? Why do they like that? Like, I like going to shows and I like seeing people pull off amazing music and do these things. But why would the average person who doesn't necessarily understand what's happening on stage enjoy this? And
right.
I think on some level, they feel that itch where they themselves are on that stage and their monologue is able to be communicated through my monologue.
Right. Well, and partially the fact that they chose to come see you or come see whomever, that also defines them somewhat. It defines their tastes. It defines them as a person. And that, I mean, perhaps that's helpful as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I do feel like there is, I mean, a lot of people approach a concert like they're scratching a different existential itch where they're able to maybe meet somebody and then have, you know, either
shared interests
or just blind sex,
right,
or they're able to get drunk or inebriated in a way that either illuminates their existence or obliterates their existence. They don't have to think about it. Slightly heavy, but those are also auxiliary reasons that I think causes people to also have that shared insanity of a live show.
Yeah. What were some of your earliest interests or influences that really stick out to you? Were you a TV guy? Were you a pop culture guy? Were you a reader? What were you into?
Yeah, TV was huge. I mean, TV was definitely the thing. And also music as well. I mean, lucky that my parents had a record collection that I could dig through and ruin.
What sort of things were you digging through as a kid?
Well, they had a lot of the experimental kind of end of things. I mean, both, I think, because their academic environment and also because some of their history, like there was John Cage and Xenakis and a lot of non-such records. And then also a fair bit of Joan Baez and the Fireside Theater, which was like a comedy troupe. So they had some of that end of things as well. Not so much the mainstream comedy stuff, not your Steve Martin and stuff, that kind of stuff, but like definitely this other end of things. A lot of the Dr. Demento was often played in my household, which is like a very specific kind of insanity. Humor, insanity, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Like definitely some weird sound effect kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I saw
Dr. Demento live once with Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. That was totally the kind of, I mean, he's an interesting character in himself. Yeah, yeah. There's some great talk about it. Those of people tuning in maybe from outside of Los Angeles, I know he's played elsewhere, but just such a heightening of the absurd and the surreal on radio waves doesn't happen too often anymore. Everything's kind of done for commercial reasons. And certainly he probably had his fair share, but it's interesting to kind of examine music as being a form of expression that doesn't necessarily include sales.
Right.
It's just something that's weird enough can get played.
Right,
it's
right.
Like watching a bad film. It has its own fine wine to it.
Yeah.
But then also my next door neighbor's father's brother. Okay.
Next door neighbor's father's brother.
Who I was best friends with the kid whose father's brother.
So your next door neighbor's uncle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. It's a lot easier to say.
Yeah, yeah.
He was the manager or something, some relationship to the George Clinton camp.
Oh, wow.
I think he might have been the dealer.
Okay.
That might have been the case. Anyways, who knows?
Yeah. Nowadays, we would call that a hype man if you're into rap. No, anyway.
It's a kind of hype man.
Yeah.
But that meant I had all the Parliament Funkadelic records when I was a kid.
Wow.
And that was huge for me.
So you had a penchant towards the alternative from an early age, it sounds like.
I don't know if it was the alternative though. That's just my reality.
Yeah. Like, well, that's what I'm saying is like what your reality was what was the alternative to most people almost. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, well, I guess so.
Like
I mean,
your parents seem like they were pretty hip is what I'm getting at.
At the same time, they were like the squares. They have a interesting pedigree. This is something I should have said earlier. They weren't bohemians. They weren't beatniks. They were too young to be beatniks, too old to be hippies.
Right.
It's a funny space. I think generationally, I also have fallen between Generation X and Generation Y.
Absolutely. I feel the same way, like where I'm not quite a millennial, but I'm not quite a Gen Xer. But you can kind of float between both of them.
Yeah. No, it's like that. I think it gives us a unique advantage to look at those kind of generational bumps where there was like these population explosions and to kind of see them for what they are a little bit more than just being the mix of it.
Right.
So I hope that's the case for us, people
right,
like us,
right.
Rather than the other side where it's just, oh, we don't have anything to glom onto. So there's nothing for us.
What sort of TV were you into? Did you have a penchant towards the absurdity or just what was on?
I mean, I didn't have cable until much, much older. My parents weren't super well, were not well to do.
Yeah.
So we didn't have early vestiges of cable or MTV until much later, all those kind of things. So, I mean, I just dealt with whatever sitcoms and
whatever
whatnot
was on.
And not even like VCRs. I mean, don't forget when that technology, when VCRs and Betamax was first rolled out, that stuff was super expensive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, like, I didn't have anything. There was a lot of different feeder systems. I just remember, like, haunting record stores a lot when I was a kid and just soaking up some of that angst from the retailers. I very clearly recall like a lot of my formative music experiences happened in those weird dusty rooms full of like a lot of vinyl at the time.
Yeah.
And even some tapes and some long box CDs. I mean, that was the era where I really started to get an understanding of what was happening around me.
Yeah.
And being way too young to it. I mean, I didn't have enough money to buy things, but the shift going on where there's,
you used to just be able to go and listen at record stores, you know?
Well, actually, when I first started, it wasn't even the case. Mm. Like Blockbuster Music was one of the first organizations where you could listen to CDs.
Mm-hmm.
They would have things at listening stations, but it'd only be a handful of CDs in terms of back catalog. It wasn't even like seemed like the labels were really utilizing what they had in the past. Like CD being a very baby invention in the early 90s.
Right.
There was only so many things that was released. And so they were kind of catching up to their back catalogs.
Yeah.
And it was even untested. Like people were also experimenting with DAT as a music format. And there was even in Santa Monica, there was like the DAT music store. And I remember like checking that out and their weird selection of classical music mostly.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a very mixed up time for formats. And that was probably what the fact that CD was seen as being the future helped the record industry survive, whereas it shouldn't have. It should probably have crumbled then. The culture disruptors like, you know, the grunge scene, which so was against commercialism and then was co-opted in that way that it was. Yeah, that should have been the death of it, the whole thing. The zine culture, the DIY tape culture should have been the thing, but they found a way out of it. They jiu-jitsued their way out, whereas they, the early aughts when the music industry should have, they didn't figure their way out of that one.
Right, right. What age were you at this point when you're starting to go to the music stores? In
13.
13?
Yeah.
And at this point, so you're like entering junior high, like where were you sociologically? What was your standing in amongst your peers?
You know, it's interesting you have this look back at history. I mean, for me, I don't think about that stuff too much, even though obviously we're all products of our history quite
a bit. I feel like
bit.
No one thinks about that on the daily, but when you go back and look at it, it's interesting. From the outside looking in, it can also do a lot of foreshadowing maybe.
Yeah, no, it definitely foreshadows. And I mean, I guess what I'm trying to point out is that I feel like it is a critical part of my story, but I don't know if somebody blundering into, say, my sound, which is so much of what I present and now is so much a construction and so much of like this release and all these different things for me, if this would color things properly or not.
Mm-hmm.
Like in some ways, the invention of music is such a powerful thing because it can be such a generalizer. And I know for some artists, it's about their story.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very lucky that it's not totally that case with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you freely that like in junior high, elementary school, junior high, high school, I was a game kid. This is before video games became quite the kind of social medium that they were. So I'm sure if I had grown up a little older, I mean like in a more recent time, I would have been some hardcore...
Like the online gamer kind of type.
I would have been like, competitive. I even considered being a competitive gamer at a certain point in my life. But at that time, it was all pen and paper role-playing games and these kind of community game systems. You know, I was heavy D&D. I mean, like I would spend almost all my time, other than music, it was all entirely spent in these fantasy worlds.
So did you start making music around that time? Is that what you're saying? Than music, or do you mean just consuming?
Earlier in that, music was also something I was doing.
So at what age did you start constructing your own music?
Like 6 or 7.
Wow, what?
I was playing clarinet at the time.
Okay.
I wanted to play bassoon, couldn't. I wasn't big enough. I wasn't the right kid for that. Bassoon was just like a cool instrument to me for whatever reason. I don't think quite the same thoughts anymore.
Was it like you saw and it was the bigger the better?
I don't know if it was the case. It might be the case. I think I have a certain like my sonority, my heartbeat or whatever is like very bass heavy. And I was able to pursue that stuff later. Like I switched from clarinet to bass clarinet later in life. I switched from just playing bass clarinet to also playing double bass.
Yeah.
I would have played tuba if given an opportunity.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was in the band for only 1 year as a kid in fifth grade, and it was I picked the baritone because it was the biggest instrument they had. And I was like, if I'm going to do this, I want to like really be loud. You know what I mean? Like I want the biggest, loudest instrument.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
It's telling in its own way.
Yeah, absolutely. Perhaps it was like compensating. Who knows? You know, I drive a huge raised truck now. No, I'm kidding. So you start playing clarinet, and did reading music take easy for you?
No, not terribly. Again, music never came easy to me, but I definitely, I felt like, a thing to it. It was something that felt right. There was a rightness to it.
Right.
Which was, and again, not because it was easy or because I was good at it, but there was still something righteous about it. So.
And when you say like kids that tend to be prodigious youth or whatever, how they can memorize and play, but they don't create, did you find yourself straying away from the page music and instantly trying to create?
Yeah, basically. Like I always wanted to do kind of my own thing. I didn't want to play with the group necessarily as well. Like, I think I tended towards instruments that necessitated other players,
mm-hmm.
double bass, bass clarinet, all these different instruments. They weren't solo instruments. I never approached them in a solo fashion.
Mm-hmm.
I was always much more rhythm section minded and such. But at the same time, like I always took to them in my own fashion. Like
mm-hmm.
I didn't really want to study what the greats had done. I kind of wanted to somehow put my fingerprints on it ever since the get, like ever since I was very young. So.
Mm-hmm. So how long did you stick with the clarinet and stuff? Were you still into that by the time you get to junior high, or had you moved on to...
No, I kept up with it all throughout high school, and I took double bass in through college.
Okay, wow.
So, I mean, junior high is when I started playing double bass.
Uh-huh.
Bass clarinet, switched over from clarinet, and then I was off to the races.
Did you dabble with any like traditional form, like rock and roll bands when you were in high school? You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
For sure. I played in like the worst, my first rock band.
With your friends and such?
Well, actually the first band I was part of, I was playing electric bass. I couldn't play funk because I was left-handed.
Okay.
And so my left hand can slap. My right hand is kind of dumb.
Yeah.
So when I'm playing bass, can I learn the traditional fashion with the left hand doing the fingering mm-hmm. and the right hand doing the picking or the playing, the thumbing?
I'm left-handed as well, and I learned to play guitar the traditional way, and I always wonder if I would be better at it if had I just like flipped it upside down like Jimmy, you know?
I think there's something to it. I think there really is. And so I never could play slap funk music, which was kind of weirdly big when I was a kid. There was like all the good bass players in my high school could do, or the people that were seen as being good.
Well, and being on the West Coast, I would imagine it would be is bigger here than other places.
Yeah, well, you have Jane's Addiction and the Red Hot Chili Peppers being big at the time, mm-hmm. and other bands as well. But those two bands were all, I just remember my high school being like really
big.
You know, if you should play the licks from Ocean Size or something like that, and then you were like seen as something. So I didn't do that. I couldn't do that.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of kept me in a odder side of things. So the first band I actually was part of was called Basically Treble. The worst. And
that's a great music nerd name.
That was like a club at my high school.
Okay.
And I joined as a young person. The actual first band I was in was called like Elvis Christ or Jesus Presley. I forget now, but yeah, one of those two. And that was terrible. It was the worst. And we played bad, like thrashy punk. And yet I played like these angular, weird, dissonant, like bass lines and everything.
And was it all other West Side kids that you were with?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Were they like skaters, surfer type kids? Did you ever get into that culture?
That's the thing is, I mean, like growing up around skaters who would want to beat me up, I shied away from that. Mm-hmm. And then I might have been a surfer given some other lifestyle things. I never could swim, but that didn't stop anyone from surfing. You just get in the water and you just paddle around.
Mm-hmm.
I had some bad moments in the ocean, so I don't go in there very often. So yeah, no, like just either between nature or nurture, if you want to talk about people and their weirdness, I stayed away from that stuff. I always have been enamored with skate culture, and it's always been like a part of my story, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of like always having friends that did that kind of stuff, always have friends that did the extreme sport kind of things,
mm-hmm.
be it like surfing or skating, things that aren't traditional sport, and yet at the same time have this like weird motion mm-hmm. and a lifestyle, really, especially growing up in Santa Monica.
I've said it on here before, but like I've always thought that like skateboarding is like a very musical, physical activity. You know what I mean? Like there's a lot of muscle memorization that would be similar to playing an instrument where, you know.
But I think it's become more athletic over time.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was a kid, I just remember being much more lyrical.
Mm-hmm.
You would see somebody with their like go get 'em style or whatever, like their weird, like thrashy style. And it wasn't about how high they could ollie or whatever. It's just how dope it looked. Just the way they would transition their tricks or the way their stance was, it was just that was the thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what makes it so musical to me in that like when you watch people play football, they're just fucking charging at each other as totally. Hard as they can. But you look at somebody skate and like you said, there's people that charge and go big or there's people that are smooth and laid back. Just like there's – you could be listening to fucking smooth jazz or you could be listening to punk rock. You know what I mean? Like where'd you go to high school? Hamilton?
Santa Monica High School.
Santa Monica High School. Was Hamilton even a thing back then?
Oh, Hamilton was definitely a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't have quite the thing that they have now. Where,
right.
You know, like there was a huge –
The magnet or like the –
They were an arts magnet, but Santa Monica High School at the time I was there had the best, like arguably or whatever, I don't know, it's definitely up to argument, but like the best high school orchestra in the country.
Oh, wow.
It was award winning and traveled around and stuff. And so.
So you were traveling with the orchestra?
Yeah, sometimes. We went to Spain and then
oh, wow.
They did some other countries in Europe as well. And there were some other trips and stuff. And I was only a part of that because I never was like first chair bass. I was never like, I did the classical thing and I did band. I mean, literally at a certain point in high school, I was taking like, 3 out of my 6 periods were all music, or 7 periods. Sorry, like 3 or 4 out of my 7 periods were all music. So,
yeah. Did you take any other subjects in high school?
I mean, you know, I just did whatever I had to, but I just did music as much as I could.
Music was just the thing. Yeah. That was it. You were never like, oh, I like history.
No, I've literally screwed myself so bad. Like, music is a very ephemeral thing. People's opinions and tastes change. And
absolutely.
Like, there's a novelty aspect to this industry where people want the new. And it's amazing to think that, you know, it's like we build this repository of information, but very, very little of our music culture nowadays really wants or like, you know, history and stuff. They want a 16-year-old.
I was just going to bring up like the fetishism with youth in current culture, particularly. I mean, there's always a fetishism with youth throughout generations, but it seems like right now with the internet, like the youth thing is so crazy. Like people in every headline, it'll be like, oh, 17-year-old beatmaker does this. And it's like, nobody's saying that if it's a 28-year-old beatmaker.
And I can totally understand that. Oh, it's, I mean, like there's just like a thing about the novelty, like, wow, this person has an extraordinary story and they're really doing it young and they have something to say and they've somehow made it past these gatekeepers where it's so crazy because it took these other people this long to get there. And mm-hmm. so there's something extraordinary about the fact that somebody's getting heard at such a young age, mm-hmm. whereas there's so many young people who want to do the thing who don't get heard. And it's mm-hmm. kind of both, I think, it's nice to know somebody your age is doing something, but also frustrating in a way that makes it even more
enticing.
Almost, yeah. And so I understand that. And so I put so many eggs in that basket, in this music basket. I'm really prepared to be like a street person fairly soon, like an eccentric street person. I've worked on my wardrobe a bit. Yeah,
with an extremely refined palate for coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, that's the other thing. Maybe this barista stuff could be something somewhere somehow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Where'd you go to college at?
USC.
USC?
I had to go to USC. There was no other options.
Why is that?
Because my mom was the dean of fine arts.
So. Oh, right. Did you get into Thornton?
Yeah. I did the Thornton Music School. Yeah, nice. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty elite. Right?
I guess so. You know, I feel like I got in through, I didn't know what I was doing when I was playing jazz in high school and stuff. I didn't know how to read changes though. I didn't know altogether what I was doing, but I felt like I got super lucky during the audition. And this is like a silly story.
We love silly stories.
Well, it's just stupid in the fact that like, I really didn't know what I was doing. Like truly in hindsight, like I did not know what I was playing when I was playing jazz. I could like tell you what the root note was and the third. And I would just basically work around those two things and just blunder. People seemed to like it and they liked some of where my ears were going, but my hands and stuff did not know the music. And mm-hmm. the one true thing about jazz is that you shouldn't be thinking about it too much. It should just be something that's coming out of a deeper place.
Yeah.
And that's when it gets good. When it's something that you're like, it's in your head too much, it just becomes a bunch of notes.
And so do you feel like you lost me as to whether you felt like you were feeling or were you thinking too much? Which
neither. I just didn't have it in my hands or in my head. I didn't have the information.
Yeah.
I didn't have it. So the thing is though, I'd been doing it with an ensemble, this really talented saxophone player named Ben Wendell, who's gone on to be like the future of jazz. He's like he's the head of one of the premier jazz groups right now in the country.
Wow.
On Concord. They're amazing. But he was in this ensemble that I was part of called Tres Gatos. There was five of us. It makes no sense. Don't worry about it. And we were playing a lot of the music. So we were playing the songs, but not knowing the soul of the songs.
Yeah.
Big songs from the fake book, what they call the fake book, which is the collection of the Great American Songbook.
Okay.
But cheat sheeted. So you know the melody and you know the changes.
Uh-huh.
And you can kind of work your way through it. And so playing on the Third Street Promenade badly, but making like very little money, making like nothing in the classical duo, making thousands a night. Anyways, so in the audition process, me and some other guys are sitting down going through some of these songs that I know enough of to play, but I don't really know.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to doom each other basically. Like, oh man, what if this song comes up? What if this song comes up? What if that? And we don't realize as we're kind of sat around, circled up, and these guys know what they're doing. And I'm just like pansying around, you know, I'm just like trying to press the fingerboard down, much less play.
Uh-huh.
That the people who are actually doing the audition come in, hear what we're doing, and they pass us all. They just give us the pass.
Wow.
So I like backdoored in. I just like totally snuck in.
So you guys are just sitting around discussing what you're going to do and they hear that. And
well, they hear us playing through the changes and like trying to
figuring it out.
But like, I just got lucky.
Huh. That's nice.
I think if they actually had sat me down and auditioned me and actually done the thing proper, I would have probably
choked
Santa Monica College. Which I'm not angry about.
Yeah.
It's a good place.
So how was the college experience for you? Did you get down with it?
Well, that's when things got a little weird, but that's okay.
Yeah. What happened?
Well, just USC being like a very fraternal place.
Yeah, yeah.
And that has its place. I mean, that's like definitely the reason to go to school nowadays. I don't think people should go to school for knowledge unless you're in a very knowledge-based, like if you need to specifically know all the names of bones in your body for some reason.
Right.
It's great. College is the spot. You could probably just go to the library down the street or go on the internet and find out the exact same information.
Right.
But I guess college is something that as a piece of paper, it can get you a job because other people have pieces of paper and they want to see people with pieces of paper.
Right.
But as a fraternal organization, it makes a lot of sense. You make friends. Those friends will go on later in life to play golf with you and you get jobs.
Business opportunities, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is a good guy. We used to get drunk together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or he saw me haze somebody once. We share a secret. I have to hire him or so blackmail me.
Oh, we tag-teamed a chick together after a keg party. What?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I didn't.
Dude, played cookie or whatever that weird game was.
soggy cookie.
I lived. I never did the fraternal thing. I never did that stuff. It was a creepy world that I like had binoculars on.
Yeah,
partially because, and I don't want to say too much, but there was a period of time in my life when not only was I making music and I was playing role playing games, but other aspects of the urban existence were part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And things that came into my hands, I would sometimes sell to other people.
Right.
So this continued on through college for periods of time. And that way I got to meet some
people. That was the most
people.
Eloquent way of putting that I've ever heard, I would like to say. But proceed.
Well, it didn't feel like I was actually making a living at it. It really felt like something that I was dicking around with because I was not savvy enough to really talk to people.
Uh-huh.
And so this was a way to talk to people. That's what it came down to.
Uh-huh.
You know, cool kids would pair off and mate and all that stuff.
But everybody needs the supplier.
Everyone needs to be somehow socially in a feeder system.
And right.
That was a way to be part of that.
At what age did you start experimenting with
13, 14.
And that was like weed or something?
Yeah, weed came in early. But actually what came in super early was acid.
Yeah.
I've said this before, but there's a moment when I should have been stealing alcohol from my dad's, you know,
little
sidebar or whatever.
Instead, you're robbing your sister's acid.
No, she wasn't the type. It was more like we just knew older kids.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have known older kids. And for like $5, you could like trip for hours.
All day, yeah.
And for like $5 a weed, you would get like the worst, like especially
headache,
down like Venice Beach.
High.
Like, oh, you'd get oregano. Like your pizza would taste good, but your weed was terrible. I mean, we didn't know what we were doing.
Right.
We just pulled our money together and we asked the kids like, hey, can we buy some weed? He's like, nah, but we got some of this other stuff. And that was the beginning of a few wonderful summers and high seasons. So that became something that paid forward and then kind of continued on through college and was a really interesting way of meeting a lot of that fraternal and sorority stuff because it wasn't that stuff anymore. I'd graduated to other things and pushing on other things. And that was an amazing way of kind of, again, getting to know a culture, not being part of it, but being very important to that culture.
Right. You did a great job of not dry snitching on yourself. Right? You danced around that perfectly.
Dude, it's, you know, it's like people don't need to know that stuff.
So it's kind of like you had another backdoor into that too, where you got to witness it and be around it, but more as a spectator and also a part of it, but from the outsider's perspective almost.
Part of it for a little while until I realized how much there was other people who made specifically livings doing these things and quickly scaring someone like me off.
Yeah, I feel you.
Yeah, like when you show up on somebody's radar, I've learned this over time. There's certain people who, because of a force of power, they don't need to necessarily be seen, but you can feel them. Or other people will do their talking or work. And being part of that was also very illuminating and educational.
It's funny because it almost sounds like you could be talking about the music industry at the same time, you know?
I feel like a large part of my education towards the music industry was part of these formative experiences of just high school socialization because it's all the same.
Right, right.
You know, people, the way people talk and emphasize and work together and stuff. The internet is an amazingly powerful new construction, but it's just an expression and expansion of our nervous system, right? We can see farther, we can hear further.
Yeah.
But we also can feel like our emotional states also get weirdly extended and our societal like decisions get also moved around. And so it's just like a bigger swimming pool that people are trying to like desperately tread in. So anyways,
I want to start talking a little more about like let's jump forward to get to where we are today. And I want to start that by saying, I think maybe the first time that I heard your name, I was one of the kids that used to go to the record store every Tuesday and just buy whatever was in the new section and release section. And I ended up buying, I think maybe in 02 or 03, The Weather Project, which was you, Radio Inactive, and Bus Driver, right?
Which is 10 years old this year.
10 years old this year. See, so it was in 03. There you go. I think that was the first time I heard your name. So how did you start breaking into that scene? When did you put down the clarinet and start picking up quantized beat machines?
Yeah. And that's the thing too. It's like, so I always, kind of parallel to playing music, I was imbibing it. I was listening to it. I was always really passionate about that same thing. Like every Tuesday, every Monday night, like being that person who was there at the record store, and not because I felt like it was a cool place. You know, there's that high fidelity myth that like the record store, it just was like, that was the source of amazement for me. Like there was these sounds that would dance in my life, not just because of substances, that just really, really gave me good feelings. And a huge revelation for me as a kid was rave culture, which was from so far away, from all the way distant UK. That's where a lot of this music culture came from. The Summer of Love stuff in 89 and on, the Acid House Summer of Love stuff. 89 on to the rave stuff was something that was really interesting to me. And
like again, around 96, 97, is that when?
No, 92. I was like 13, 14.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah,
I was
way too
young to rave.
I never even found out about the rave culture stuff. Like I had never hit Alaska until the late 90s, like 96, 97. Mm. And it's funny because I always talk about like how I thought that I saw the first generation of that, of like kids taking ecstasy and fucking chilling in a basement listening to drum and bass and shit, and now we're in the second generation of that. This is so strange.
Sure.
But anyways, so the rave culture hits you in 92 and you get into it
hugely, like crazy, massively. It hits me like a ton of bricks. And like,
were there raves out here at the time?
Dude, rave culture was really huge. Big in LA. We actually had an art rave scene for a long time. Mm-hmm. That again, like acid house culture in the UK was not seen as being like a party culture so much as it's like a social movement away from the Thatcher area extremes of disparity of money, culture, and all this stuff. So it's like, it's seen as being not as like, at least in hindsight, like people talk about it as being less about like some never ending party. We just did ecstasy and checked out. It was like a little bit more socially active and conscious. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of ecstasy in people's eyeballs, basically.
Yeah.
And then it also had a parallel out here in LA for whatever reason, be it the art culture that was happening in the late 80s in LA. There was just something about Los Angeles that was on fire. And part of that was racial politics, and part of that was drugs, and part of that was just the fact that it just – art lived here in a way that was fundamental to American culture at that time.
Absolutely.
And so we had our raves, and they were amazing. Like if you ever get a chance, like – there's some documentation of this kind of stuff, but a lot of it was just these illegal, weird moon parties, like the kind of full moon parties that would happen out in the middle of the desert. And also just like, I just remember being way too young to go to a normal club, but going to these, like I only went to a handful, but like to one of those warehouse waves where they literally are breaking into a warehouse, roll in a sound system and go until the cops come and then you run.
Wow.
You know, sound systems running like faster than you are. It's like, it's literally in the back of a flatbed truck so they can just like drive.
Just dip.
Yeah. And yeah, there's like lots of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And like Insomniac, which has now gone on to these huge like EDM events, like that started with illegals back in the day. Like people like Pasquale, who people, you know, it's like one of those dudes who gets like routinely has like millions of people come through his Las Vegas events.
Right.
Like, you know, like up to hundreds of thousands of people at a single event. Like that dude was just like weird promoter dude that just did the, you know, took a chance on this kind of form of music, especially the rave stuff when that started to hit. And then, you know, a lot of it was UK, but some of the American artists like Moby and some of those people came up at that same time.
Right.
And just, yeah. It was
and so that stuff
special.
Affected you. And did you, was it like, I need to try this?
No.
I need to make this?
It was like, what is this mysterious magic? I will never know what this thing is because the DJ is literally making it up on stage. And then you learn really
and
quick.
And so then you had like, to take the apart the TV.
It's like you really learn quickly the DJ is not making up all these songs.
Right.
He's actually playing other people's music and
right.
still with some artistry, and like the selection is still a mystery, and to figure out what somebody was playing was so incredibly hard.
Mm.
It was crazy back in the day because not only was it like the DJ wasn't just up high on some like pedestal and you couldn't see, literally they would cover their records with like whatever it was
black
it out. Yeah. Because they didn't want to have their,
well, and there was no
set.
Shazam back then. There's no Google. There's no nothing.
Dude, it was the most satisfying mystery when you figured out what somebody was playing, just because you had a fragment of a sample and you were able to like go to the store and like figure out what somebody else sampled. And then like, oh, that guy's production style sounds similar to this. So maybe it was like an illegal white label that he did and like blah, blah, blah. So
yeah,
I started to get real heavy into that stuff.
Wow.
And only by the time I got to college did I have any kind of confidence to start asking the right questions to figure out how things were made.
Uh-huh.
Because, man, the
who were you asking?
I mean, at that point I was like taking classes and synthesizers and like,
okay.
And I had friends that had like rich friends that had samplers and synthesizers, but I myself didn't really have a chance to afford anything. So I was like, had all these like little like cheapo guitar pedals, and I was like running things through my bass and like looping things and trying experiments, but like no knowledge, like because the stuff was so out of control, so like off limits,
right?
And there was just a few moments of daylight. I just remember a few records that kind of broke it down, or some of the records would have like little like sections of the record that were made for scratching. Actually, this is like, I never was a scratch kid,
right?
But scratch culture was hugely fundamental to me, and I had a bunch of those records just because I could hear the sounds on their own,
right?
And like play with them. So like I got decks early in my college life to spin mostly drum and bass and those kind of variants of those kind of styles, but also just like to try to wrestle with the thing. And I think the part of the reason a lot of DJs do make good producers is because they have to wrestle with the music. They have to figure out, they know that there's like 8 bars before the break and whatever.
Right.
But nowadays it's especially like rulesy because of how easy it is, the technology is. But I just remember back in the day, like it was so easy to make music that didn't line up and wasn't quantized and stuff. It was hard to get things quantized properly. It was hard to have all the machines play together.
Right.
It wasn't just a matter of some MIDI protocol. It was actually like things just didn't like each other.
Huh.
So the secrets that these producers held were a little bit more mystical than nowadays, where it's just like, oh, well, here in Ableton, this is the trick you do. And this is the filter, and this is like the Skrillex sound, and this is, you know, massive preset, and boom, 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 and you're there. And that's okay, but
Oh, I would just run it through the trap filter.
Oh, dude, the trapifier?
Did you see
that? Dude, it's amazing. Yeah, you just turn it up, turn it down, get turned.
Turn it up and get turned. I love the fact that, like, you had to fucking really strive to teach yourself. You know what I mean? Like, that's amazing.
I also, and this is something I feel is part of my story and probably not that important, because I definitely feel part of a wonderful community of musicians here now.
Yeah.
LA beat scene, just LA general, Dub Lab. These are just like these, Low End Theory as a community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which doesn't just include just beat makers. It's like a larger circle. Amazing.
Yeah.
But I do very much remember coming up, no open doors. Nobody wanted the weird kid from Santa Monica to spin their bad drill and bass or their weird form of jungle or whatever. So there wasn't any community. And this is something that really structured my early musical life, is that like this feeling that there wasn't any like shared secrets, that I just had to figure this stuff out.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the reason I've come into my sound. And I feel it's a gift now that I wasn't let into play. Because I know all those dudes aren't around anymore.
And it's interesting that you word it that way, because that's another thing that I keep hearing like thematically throughout your story, is like it's the kind of this feeling of always being the outsider. But now the outsider, you know, you have a great following and like there are people that follow you now. You know what I mean?
Well, I definitely feel like there's an important thing to do, which is to not do that to anybody else ever. Like I'm not going to ever try to close. Like if somebody on SoundCloud hits me up and wants me to hear their music, I'm going to listen to it.
Right,
like,
right.
I know very acutely what it feels like to be awash in a lot of wonderful culture and sound and not feel part of any of it.
Mm.
And like, why would you ever want to do that to somebody? Both right. because it's just shitty to like to treat somebody like they have something less to say, whereas their voice is just as valid as my own or anybody's, because they have something honest to say. If they have something honest to say, then it's just as valid. If they're just trying to make a buck or just get some shine, I could give a shit.
But, right.
So in that way, it's very important to have that community emphasis. And also just that thing too, it's just like, man, there are so many talented people.
Absolutely.
And it's just, I mean, and sometimes talent comes in the form of just being able to work that extra mile, or sometimes it is a natural thing. And just, you know, just they deserve ears. These people, I want what's best for, and this sounds so cheesy, but I want what's best for the music. And that's for as much good stuff to be heard as possible, rather than just like something easy.
Right.
And a lot of people chase easy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
After the rave stuff, and you're starting to play and looping things, like you said, with your guitar pedals and such, like, what is the first piece of hardware after the techniques that you have? Did you pick up an MPC?
No, I never did the MPC, even though I think I would have liked to. It was a little on my price range, because it wasn't just you had to get the MPC. You had to get all the peripherals, like the zip drive and all that other stuff. And it cost cash. And again, I wasn't the smartest dealer to be able to figure that side out.
Right.
I think I was spending money in other weird places. I was having like... I had a suit made once that was all camo patterned, like a mod suit that was camo patterned, because I was a junglist for whatever stupid reason.
That's awesome.
It's not the best choices made, but I did get an A3000 A3000 Yamaha sampler.
Okay.
And that was my first piece of like real serious hardware.
And does that have pads and keys?
No pads.
Just keys?
No keys, nothing. Just like, just the head, just the unit.
Okay.
And I just... got like breakout stuff. I was doing a lot of stuff on, I got early, early sequencing software with like Pro Tools, which I still use, just a much more modern version. I used Logic really early on and tried stuff, and then quickly switched over to Pro Tools, and then just kind of worked my way up.
How long is it when you start making, you know, what you were calling them back then, but making beats essentially?
Yeah.
Like before you started finding that sense of community, like when did, because I already knew you, like I said, in 2003 as like a dude who was like kind of outwardly orbiting around the Blode kind of.
Sure.
Almost,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing too, is like I never went to Blode. I never did.
Right.
I never went to, when it, especially its heyday, like I had friends that were, as a kid, who were like wannabe MCs who were around the Freestyle Fellowship and doing that stuff, but I never actually went downtown or to Leimert Park to do that kind of stuff. It's just, I missed a huge swath of LA by not driving, by just being a shut-in in Santa Monica.
Right.
There's all this amazing stuff happening, the riots happening and stuff. I was just like chilling in somebody's backyard when that went down. It's just a trip. But so, it was really like, in college, I was in college radio, which again, is such an amazing crucible that so many people's like young musical story goes through is either being an MD or a PD or just
that's
being
one
a
of
DJ
the things
station.
I'm most sad about is that the college I ended up staying at didn't have a college radio station because I always wanted to get involved in that.
Yeah, and it's anyway. Being dismantled in general across yeah. the country anyways. Mm-hmm. It's as programs get cut and things mm-hmm. get changed around mm-hmm. to being more like moneyed, that stuff gets the first thing that goes out the window, and the whole College Music Journal, CMJ, is like less of an emphasis.
So you had your own show on?
I had not only my own show, and which was all this kind of records that I've been collecting for a while, this rave stuff, but then like, and I had of course the 4 a.m. to 6 a.m. slot at first and moved my way up and then was eventually the MD of this radio station. But alongside me was this guy, Mark McNeil, who ended up founding Dublab.
Oh, okay.
And so I was part of that story as that was kind of starting to happen. We were the first college radio station with the most electronic music emphasis. So we were really at this electronic music push, like, you know, all the DJs that were on there. That was a first sense of community, but not a producer community. It was just a musical community. We were playing for like nobody. Like there was nobody listening to our station or very few people. I remember at one point I like got on the airwaves and was like, I'll give someone $5 if they call in. no calls. Like, well,
that's great.
Should not ask that question out loud too often. But then that was the first sense of community. And then later on, Dublab became this huge internet success, whereas internet radio was like a very new idea when they started up in 99, I want to say. And so I was one of the DJs on that one. And that was the first place where my own music got heard. And then my first release was on a Dublab record, Dublab Presents Freeways, that came out on Emperor Norton Records, which was an interesting label at the time. And happened because eventually I found a community that I was part of.
Yeah. And like I said, or like you said, you were there from the very start of what has developed into Low End Theory and everyone that orbits around it. I know Kev used to throw like kind of almost ravey parties back in the day, didn't
he?
Well,
he was part of Herb. He was part of the, I don't want to say the editorial staff. I think the design staff. He might have been actually the head designer at Herb for a period of time. He really got... Like he was part of the auditorium for a while, and that was like the kind of early vestiges of Jungle. And like he definitely did a lot of production for the Blowed people, but like his own thing, I felt like really came into itself at Concrete Jungle.
Yeah, Concrete Jungle. That's right.
Where he was running both the main room and he had like edit doing like the back room, like hip hop DJ, the smoke room basically, and the front room. This was all at the Silver Lake. It used to be Spaceland, but now it has a different name.
Right. Yeah.
Satellite.
Okay. Yeah.
And so the front room was Jungle, and he picked a young bus driver to be the MC in that room, which is crazy because he wasn't good at first.
Uh-huh.
He didn't know what he was doing. He was talking. It was like way too chatty over, you know, the beginning, and then like way too like not saying enough or blah, blah. And now he's like, it's just interesting where people cut their teeth. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
That definitely is a good example.
Is that where you met Bus at first? Or
I think so. I must have. I mean, but I don't think I really met him at that point. He was dude on stage and I was not the dude on stage.
Right. Know? When did you become the dude on stage?
Yeah, that was a little later.
What year?
I don't know. It was actually like...
Because I feel, like I said, I've been in California since 01 is when I moved here, I think. And at first, actually, I was going to a school in Pomona. And so I used to go to a lot of shows at the Glass House. I could be crazy, but I feel like I used to hear your name around there at the time, like at various rap shows. And I know that I used to see like Subtitle down at shows all the time and stuff. And that's somebody that you've known for a while or no?
Yeah, for a while. Not since 01, but I mean... So here's the thing. So
that's a small scene is what it is.
Well, here's the thing. Mad Lib has been hugely influential to me in terms of opening doors. Like that first Double I Presents Freeways release, Mad Lib was on there as well. And as well as like Mia Doy Todd was on there. Dintel was on there. There was a bunch of us in this kind of odd assortment. It's like a really weird collection in hindsight. But I had a song that kind of got a nice look and college radio treated me very well. And again, being lucky enough to be, this is before the totally disruptive period of the internet, but to be on a record that was pushed through college radio, the college radio system, meant I got a lot more play. I had a song on the record called A Mash Note, which did these rounds that I never even realized. And again, other songs like people like Madlib being on there just were really fundamental. And Madlib ended up doing a remix of my first record, Invention. And then he ended up taking a song from Invention and making a song, a accordion for Mad Villain. So there's this funny tendrils that happened and the hip hop emphasis was partially because I was doing a lot of stuff with Carlos Nino, who really brought a bus driver and this guy Satch from Global Flotations on board. And so those were my two hip hop, like those are the first people I had MC on my stuff. But like it had nothing to do with the fact that I was close proximity with him or anything. It was just Carlos was like, just really like matchmaking.
A connector.
Kind of fun. A fundamental spider in the middle of the web.
Right.
There's a few people in LA. Daddy Kev's one, Carlos Nino's another, and Mark McNeil. And then there's others that you could point at, but those three are like on the creative side, like the most genius visionaries, super important to the LA story of the aughts.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and Carlos reaching back even further, but like, it's like he was like almost under 21 and he was doing like crazy heavy hitting jazz shows and like bringing in the Blowed in on that.
Wow.
Like taking people like Durf Reklaw and matching them up with like Peace or whatever. And like,
wow,
just the weirdest stuff was happening. And that kind of friction is what makes heat. That's what makes this stuff possible. And it, so like, okay, so now looking at these, like these people who are a little older, a little elders, you know, like really showing the way, but we always are hungry for that young thing.
Right.
It's beautiful. That dichotomy, the fact that they have these people who are willing to kind of be quieter on some of the release stuff. I mean, Daddy Kev has an amazing discography. He doesn't do as much of it anymore, but he's very happy, it seems like, to have spaces that bring those kind of frictions together.
Yeah. Well, and he's so fundamental in allowing people's music to be heard as well. Because he's literally
become a distribution point.
He is. He's literally a distribution point. Yeah. And also, he is a gatekeeper of sorts, but he's also a really good curator as well. You know, very talented man. We're in his studio right now. All praise is due to Daddy Kev.
Exactly.
I want to get to the point where you are on stage. What was your early stage like? And then, of course, I want to just briefly touch on how it eventually came to where it is now with the Monome.
Yeah.
And briefly explain what the Monome is to people, because they're going to see it on a video and they're not going to understand it. And you've tried to explain it to me and I almost still don't understand it looks awesome and it's really cool to watch.
It all hopefully makes sense when it starts to be envisioned. I mean, hopefully when people see it, it makes sense. But the basic truth is that in 2001, when I started playing shows and electronically, I had taken all the stuff from my studio and just brought it basically with me. And I played instruments. I had this modified guitar and I bass clarinet, all these kind of things, these things. Two hands, 10 fingers, not that much happening.
Uh-huh.
You know, some changes here, there, very atonal, very strange, dissonant compositions. Cause that's just what I was afforded. Like that's just what I was bringing to the table. And so I did that for 2 years. And then sometime in 2003, I don't exactly remember the month, but I played a show and I'm amazed that people would book me, but I mean, this was kind of the scene. There was a nice amount of experimentation happening in the scene because the overground rave scene was so saturated. There was no going into it. You were playing cheesy drum and bass or cheesy whatever. Or you were on the underground, and the underground was teeming with life. Just it was more on the hip hop side. So you'd do that, or the breakcore stuff. I mean, the breakcore shows were amazing back in the day. And so that stuff was happening. And so 2003, I played a show in San Diego, and I met the people who, this guy Brian Crabtree and this guy Peter Segerstrung, and they were together, but mainly Brian, were making what became the Monome. They had a very early prototype of it at the time, and I was just blown away because a lot of my music is about sample or taking existing instruments and treating them like samples. So you treat the thing like something you want to destroy and work with like taffy. You know, it's like you're kind of constantly pushing and pulling on the audio source to make it what it is. Mm-hmm. To see an instrument in the Monome that could deal with samples in this way that felt like what I was trying to do in the studio, but doing it live, was a revelation. And the thing that's crazy is that in 2003 it was doing that. I'm still doing pretty much the same thing it was doing in 2003 in my modern show. And still to this day, not much other equipment can do that.
Wow.
And I don't understand. We literally all the promise of all this technology, things literally, like there's all these programs that have come and gone since. There's all this stuff. It's just like, it's exploded. The stuff, the possibilities are limitless in all these ways. And yet I'm still using a piece of gear that's fundamentally from 2003 and hasn't changed very much.
Do you feel like you've mastered the Monome?
No.
Do you learn things every day?
Yeah, I learn things all the time. I mean, I feel like if someone were to sit down at a piano and say, I've mastered this,
right,
like, we'd laugh at them. And I feel the same way about this. It's a real instrument.
Wow.
It takes practice and I put a lot of sweat into it and everything, but I still feel like I'm learning so much all the time.
That's
all
awesome.
The time.
Tell us about the new record that just came out.
Yeah, sure.
Anticon.
I have a record called Drown Out. It's my first on Anticon. Anticon being a label that's been around for 15 years. So a long while. They work
We've had Sean on the podcast. Awesome. We're Anticon fans. And Baths, actually, too.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, he was our first episode.
Well, wonderful. I mean, Baths, I'm so proud to say that I'm part of his story. Sean, a little less, but I've known him since before he was the head of Anticon. And just so proud of those guys. And so, I mean, like...
Yeah, I think Baths actually brought you up on our podcast. Because the first show that he played as Baths, I think, was like one where you guys were at all at... what is it, Henry Fonda?
This was before he was Baths. He was playing as Post Fetus.
That's right, Post Fetus. He said that. You're the one who invited him to that show, right?
We had him on, and we all liked what he did. I mean, I had played some other shows with him, and he always had these different ensembles. But to put him on that show and to know that he made Cerulean like whatever the next weekend.
Yeah,
it's dope. It's
amazingly talented guy.
Yeah,
but anyway, tell us about your record.
Yeah, so Drown Out. It's the first on Anticon, and It was a difficult record for me to make. It was a record I feel like it kind of tumbled out of me in this fashion, because it's a lot of about some grief that was going on in my life, some death and departure, as well as some strife in general. I think we all live in this constant state of fooling ourselves that the world is okay, that our existence tomorrow, the sun will rise and the sun will set, and we kind of continue. When you have disruptors in your life, when you have this like punctuation marks, be them question marks or exclamation points, that wake you up to the fact that tomorrow is not promised. It is something that is given to us by our own powers. When that fully sets in, when you know, it's like what we do today have these ramifications. It's very paralyzing, and it begs that question even more, like what we're doing about it, how we're living our lives, what our choices are, what choices are out of our hands. When you start to think in that stew too much, it's hard. The weight of it becomes unbearable to a degree, and it's easy to kind of psychologically have difficulty. There isn't that many tools at least in my toolbox. I didn't have many tools to deal with that stuff. So I did what came naturally to me, which was to make music out of it. But that wasn't a solution. It just became this weird way of taking the colors and starting to blend them all together into paint in a kind of way. So I spent a series of months in that thing. And part of that was, like I said, death. And part of it was sickness. My dad was diagnosed with very bad tongue cancer and not given that much hope. And then other friends had some sickness, and Austin Peralta passed, and all this stuff happened in a very short period of time in my life. A very congested period of 2012. And that was the year I kind of stopped. Mm. I couldn't make a record. I couldn't just release something. I couldn't do what I had done traditionally. And yet I have no other tools. I have nothing else I've ever done.
No way to cope.
No way to cope.
Yeah.
And this record isn't coping, but it's the record that came out of that.
Is it darker than your other previous projects?
I don't know.
Because I always associate, when I hear the word Daedalus, or like the name Daedalus, I associate it with kind of these like angelic melodic beats. Like that's what...
It's darker then.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like,
but there's some stuff in there like that too. Yeah. There's some uplift. I mean, there was a push and pull with myself about like what the record should become. And that was part of it was that.
Are you happy with it?
Yeah, I'm overjoyed with it. Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. Like it became something that was totally outside of myself, and that's all what I'm looking for anyways. If anything comes truly from my own voice, I don't think it really, like it's something again for my ears, maybe more than for other people, but since this kind of transcended that, I'm very proud of the ways it kind of start to build. And hopefully when people hear it, when they come across it, if they come across it in a natural fashion, it's not a hyphy record. It's not this record that like demands attention.
Right.
I'm cool with that. Like I've done 13 records. Like I'm okay with some softballs in the mix that hopefully communicate to people something about their own depth or their own situation, and that they're not alone, and that the community is complete, and that we are out for each other. I'm like really looking out for people who are going through similar things, because as much as I have my wife and I have like these other support structures, I felt pretty lost.
Right.
Part of it is because stuff, you know, my wife was also going through things too. And it's like, everyone's going through things constantly. And it's like, I really want to be a better person looking out for other people in ways that are something I can own, which is partially through music.
Right.
So that's, you know, it's been a nice journey in that way too, to have this record finally come out after months and months of kind of dealing with the things and stuff, and actually start to immediately connect with people who are going through similar things. Not just because the story I'm telling, but just because the actual music on the thing communicates it. And that's important.
And communicating with people through the music in a sense also prevents them from feeling like an outsider in some way too.
Totally.
Which kind of brings the thing full circle. And, thank you. That was a great podcast. I really enjoyed talking to you. Where can people find you online?
I do all my own social media. So anywhere that says Daedalus, the way I spell it, Daedelus, will be me, hopefully. I mean, unless...
So Twitter, Daedalus.
Yeah, maybe not Kick. K-I-K. I don't know who does Daedalus.
I don't know what Kick is.
Don't worry about it.
I've been getting a lot of...
It's Fet Life. Don't worry about that.
I don't even know what that means.
Fetish culture. Oh, anyways,
I've been getting so many tweets about, like spam tweets about Kick lately. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
It's like Snapchat, but for adulty stuff.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I think. Or not to say that Snapchat isn't. But anyways, I don't do that kind of stuff, but I'm talking like the core...
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
MySpace.
It's all Daedalus, Daedelus, right?
Yeah. And feel free to like actually reach out and say words, because I'm out there reading it. I might not always be in the best place to respond, be it on tour or something else in life, but I'm definitely there.
But I gotta say, you're awesomely responsive as far as phone communication and email, so thank you for that as well.
Dude, of course. Thanks for having
me.
Yeah,
most definitely. I appreciate it, man. And I look forward to hearing the song that we're gonna see you perform on the Monom, which is gonna be called...
It'll be a mix.
It's going to be a mix. Awesome. Yeah. That's even better. Thank you guys for tuning in. This was kind of neat. My name is Lee. You guys might know me as Intuition. You can find me on Twitter @itsintuition. You can find my man Ben Shim behind the boards making the shit sound buttery @IamDatabase. Yes. Find us on kindofneat.net. follow us on Facebook, just kind of neat. So much words. Follow us, rate us, subscribe, give us 5 stars, blah, 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 blah. Thank you so much, Daedalus.
Thank you very much.
Really had a great time with that conversation.
Appreciate it.
Thank you guys for tuning in. This was kind of neat.
That was awesome. Thank you so much.
Dude, of course not.